Welcome to After the Buzzer from the friendly confines of the man cave. Mm-hmm. Good to be back. It's been a little while.
It has. I've back from the injury list.
That's right. I've been under the weather and I'm over the weather. And we're ready to get just at the right time because things are starting to amp up here in sports writing world, as everybody knows in our biz, mm-hmm. when you start getting ready for football season. But anyway, my name is Mike Gross, and alongside me is Gordy Jones, as always. Gordy, how are you, man?
I'm outstanding.
That's good. And it's good to be back. I haven't been here for a while. Even when I was doing it over the phone. So away we go. And we're guestless this week, but we have a lot of things to talk about.
Yes, we do.
So it's kind of, I don't know if it's a good thing, but there's a lot of things that I think we can hash around that I think are pretty noteworthy. And let's start, I think, with Bill Russell, mm-hmm. Who passed away the other day, and one of the all-time greats of American sports, and a little bit beyond, and we can get to that, but let's do basketball first. Mm-hmm. Gordy, your sort of take on the career of Bill Russell.
There's a couple things here. The first one, Bob Ryan, great sports writer for the yep. Boston Globe forever, and he, who actually, I didn't realize this, I heard him on a podcast the other day. He has a podcast with Jeff Goodman that he does, and he talked about just how Russell, well, I didn't know this, first of all. Ryan actually started covering the team the year after Russell retired. Russell retired in 68-69, went out as a champion the 11th time in 13 years that he was a champion.
And player coach.
Yeah, exactly. Also significant. The yeah. first black head coach in a major North American sport. Yep. But Ryan labeled him the greatest NBA figure of all time. And I thought that was a good way to phrase it, because between the way he backstopped those great Celtics teams of the 50s and 60s and his activism off the floor and just what a towering figure he was in every sense of the word, I think that was the best way to describe Bill Russell, his life, his career.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty good way to say it. Yeah. I had not heard that, and then that I like that.
That's I do too.
That's pretty good because, you know, he wasn't, I don't think he was the best basketball player ever. I don't think he was the great, even if you say that greatest and best are not mm-hmm. exactly synonymous. Now, I wouldn't say he's the greatest basketball player ever, but let's just talk about the basketball career for a minute. Mm-hmm. To me, it's like, if you're a team sport athlete, mm-hmm. What should you want? You should want to be the best player on the best team. Mm-hmm. You should want to make your teammates better. And ultimately, you should want to win the championship. You should want to win the last game of the year. Well, go all the way back to high school. He won two state California state championships in high school. Mm-hmm. Two NCAAs at the University of San Francisco, not Duke or Kentucky or UCLA. Olympic gold medal.
In 56, 11, yes.
11 NBA titles in 13 years. On every one of those championships, he was the best player. He was the unquestioned leader. He was the foundational piece. Yeah. Nobody in American sports has ever matched that. Nobody's ever done 60% of that.
Yeah.
It's just that by itself stands alone. I would be surprised if anybody on the planet in a major sport has ever done that
yeah.
in terms of doing what you want to do if you're a team sport athlete.
I mean, you can add the smallest of asterisks and say, well, okay, you have to go through more teams now.
Nobody could do it now.
I mean, it's like the Warriors have won 4 in the last 8 years, and that's kind of incredible in and of itself, yeah. given how many games you have to play.
It is.
But nonetheless, I mean, just in that context, you know, you can only play who's in front of you. You can only play in the era in which you play. And that's, there's no question he's, you know, right up there in the pantheon. I mean, it was interesting. I forget who wrote this. Somebody wrote about Russell the other day. And they talked to Tommy Heinsohn several years ago, and how he was underappreciated in his own city, which of course gets back to the racial element.
Yeah.
And just, you know, he was the greatest winner in pro sports. And Tommy Heinsohn goes, yeah, he did all this, and they named a bleeping tunnel after Ted Williams.
There you go.
Which is a sad commentary about just how things were. And of course, we've all read the things about his house being vandalized, et cetera, and just everything he put up with. And, you know, he was, by all accounts, the greatest of teammates, but also a very prideful man, and made no secret of his disdain for how he was treated by the people in Boston. He loved his team, did not love his city.
I didn't actually read, his daughter wrote something about this.
Yeah, I saw that too.
I didn't read that, but I read somebody talking about it, and they were saying that when he'd go on the road, like when they'd go on a road trip, the Celtics, well, their house would start to get vandalized. Like people like tip over their garbage cans and stuff like that, and they called the police, and the police said, well, it's raccoons that are doing it.
Yeah.
So Russell calls the cops and says, well, you know what, I'm going to buy a gun.
Yeah,
and all of a sudden the raccoons stop showing up.
Yeah, I read that too.
Isn't that odd? Isn't that interesting? Yeah.
Yeah.
So this is the city that you're delivering championships for.
Yeah, it's a really sad commentary, and you'd like to hope it has changed, but I mean, I don't live in Boston. I've only been to Boston occasionally, and so I have no idea what the mindset is in this day and age.
Well, I got to believe that it's not what it was then. And we are talking about the 50s and 60s, which is a long time ago. But it's not completely gone away, I'm sure. Mm-hmm. And this leads to another interesting thing, which is I think of, in the 60s, I think of three guys who were sort of activists in their own way. I'm talking about Ali and Jim Brown and Bill Russell.
Right.
And I think they all had a sort of a different niche, because Ali was so in your face. Mm-hmm. And so, actually, a lot of people found him charismatic and kind of an irresistible figure. But also, the in the face thing turned people off. Brown was sort of a dour guy, humorless guy. Russell had a niche in between there, kind of, I thought.
A
sense of humor, was able to just carry all of that in an amazing way.
I think there was a real dignity about him.
Yeah, that's for sure. That's right.
And he wrote a very well done autobiography called Second Wind, where he talked about
that book.
Book was great. I need to reread it because I haven't read it in
I don't forever. Really remember. Me too. I don't really remember it, but I remember loving it. I remember thinking it was so good.
So well done.
And a lot of pretty intimate things. I remember him talking about his girlfriend that he had at the time, and how much he just couldn't believe how great sex was with her, and that kind of stuff. You know, it was
groundbreaking. Yeah, I would say
it was like, if I'm going to do this, I'm going to do it for real.
Yeah,
you know, that's what it felt like. How good a player was he? How would he translate to today?
I think he translates. It's funny you mention that, because I have. Well, all my coworkers are younger than me, of course, but we had a discussion. One of them is a basketball fan, and he said, well, how would Russell do against Giannis? And I said to him, better than you think. And because, let's just translate, say Russell had the training that they have now.
Yeah.
Say he had the equipment opposed to playing in low-top chucks.
He played in those low-top chucks. He had those sort of like modified chucks that had a little yellow thing on the side. Sometimes he...
Yeah, so
how the hell?
Say he was flying a charter instead of commercial. And you know, any number of factors, and I'd put him right there. I mean, I'd put him right there with anybody. I just think the way he played, the desire he showed, the pride he had, I think that all would come through.
He's better suited to maybe match up with a guy like Giannis than a guy like Shaq, maybe,
right,
who was 330 pounds and could you know. But there are no low post players today. Correct. I think Russell might fit better today than maybe 10 years ago.
Look at some of the clips you've seen of him in the last several days. Just how he ran the floor.
Oh, yeah.
Like a gazelle.
Yeah.
You know, he didn't have to be a great offensive player. Just run down and wait for, you know, Sam Jones or whomever to throw you the ball.
Yeah, yeah. I was listening to some... I've consumed a lot of Russell content in the last few days. And somebody was saying that... they asked him how he would do against Shaq, and he said, yeah, I think I'd do pretty damn good, because I'd run him to death.
I think that's true.
I'd beat him down the floor every single time. I would run him
to
death. And there's no doubt that's what he would do.
Which leads me back to a little side topic that we discussed before about the 2001 Sixers and how Theo Ratliff got hurt halfway through that season when they were 42-14. And they ended up playing the Lakers in the finals with Dikembe, which didn't turn out well because Shaq just crushed him. And Theo would have done the same thing.
Theo, that's right. I was not... I think Larry Brown screwed that one up a little bit.
I think so. Yeah. Well, Theo broke his wrist.
He did. Yeah, that's right. It was injuries were a factor. And the other thing is Russell would have been great at like coming out and hedging on the pick and roll and then recovering.
I think his game would translate pretty well. Yeah. I think he would.
One thing you have to understand is you go back and look. He was 6'9", 225 pounds. We think of him as a 7-footer. He wasn't.
Right.
He wasn't. And there have been times since he retired where I don't know how he would have fit in terms of being a low post guy trying to. I mean, I don't know how that would work. But I almost think he'd fit better now than.
Because of how open the game is. Yeah. You know? Just because of how the court is opened up and, you know, and athleticism and skill is more emphasize now.
Right. Now, I don't know how good his ball skills were. My memory of his ball skills were that they were just okay for a great player.
Right.
So that, you know, and the premium on ball skills is very high right now in the NBA, no matter what else you think of the game. Mm-hmm. There's no doubt about that. But yeah, a guy who could run and compete and the mental and physical toughness that he had, he would have been fine. He would have been fine.
A couple notes. I talked to Pat Williams, the former Sixers general manager, on the phone yesterday, and he was telling me some Bill Russell stories. He said that Pat's first year in the NBA was 68-69, which was Russell's last year as a player. That year in the playoffs, the Celtics took out the Sixers in 5 games. So after, this tells you how long ago it was, after game 5 in the Spectrum, you know, the Celtics closed out the series, Pat escorted Russell back to an office so he could call a radio station in Boston.
Wow.
This is how different of an era it was. Yeah. So anyway, after he's done with this interview, Pat looks at him and says, well, how do you think you guys are going to, you think you guys can beat the Lakers in the finals? And Russell said, does a bear shit in the woods?
He was fairly confident, confident. Into his 80s, he was fairly confident.
But although they were down 2-0 and 3-1 and came back and beat that Laker team.
Oh, right.
Memorably in game 7 with the balloons in the rafters in the Forum. And the other thing I wanted to mention, I read this story that Jack McCallum wrote in 1988 when Russell was coaching the Sacramento Kings. It was an ill-fated stint there. And his quote was, he was talking about his playing career, he said, I determined how the game was going to be played. It was going to be played my way, which I thought was a pretty good statement. And then he mentioned that at that stage, Bird Magic and Michael Jordan were the only ones who could do that. So I thought that was a pretty... And I say that not only to just emphasize how he was, but also to kind of segue into Vin Scully's death. If in the case of Russell, he determined how the game was going to be played, Vin Scully kind of determined how it was going to be described and seen and heard.
He's
really, both of these guys are kind of the last link to a bygone era. You know.
Yeah, I guess they are, and you don't know necessarily why that has to be, but it sort of feels like it is. Vin Scully, to me, it's interesting about, here's what's interesting to me about Vin Scully. You can think of a lot of broadcasters who you would think of as more versatile than him. Mm-hmm. I can't really imagine him hosting the Olympics or being on the Today Show like Costas or guys like that. But here's a guy who was an extreme specialist at this one thing and was able to get so good at that it became bigger than the specific specialization. He was so good at that. I just heard the other day, the Diamondbacks had this guy named Socrates. This is near the end,
of course.
And he was a pretty. I don't think he's in the big leagues anymore. But he's coming to the plate. So Tim Kirkjian told this, and so he's coming to the plate. So Scully uses it as an opportunity to do this like 5-minute dissertation on Socrates,
of course.
The Socrates, while not missing anything about the game and weaving it all together. And Kirkjian, I guess, was just listening on the radio or whatever, and he was like, what the hell? This is unbelievable. And he would do that kind of stuff.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of people have talked about that, how it was uncanny how he would launch into this story like that.
Yeah.
And the batter would inevitably foul off X number of pitches until
open him out.
Until Vin finished that story. So I saw a clip the other day, and it was from, I think it was from when Baumgartner was still pitching for the Giants against the Dodgers in Dodger Stadium. And it was that kind of, he was telling a story about Baumgartner and how his wife were and he were out wandering their property and they came upon a rattlesnake. So Baumgartner took an axe and chopped this rattlesnake up. And the story doesn't end there. It ends with them finding two baby rabbits within the remains of this snake. And Vin's telling this whole story, how they nursed this rabbit back to life. And then as soon as he's done with the story, the Dodger lines a single center. Oh, and the Dodgers have something going. It was just amazing to me. He tells this whole story and then it's, oh, by the way, now they have first and second with nobody
out. He had a smooth...
Oh my God!
Just the smoothness, well, it was just amazing. He was an original, and he goes back with me to the book, The Boys of Summer. I started thinking about him, and of course we didn't hear him all the time around here. He's out in L.A., but you did see him enough, though. He did enough national stuff. He did golf.
He did some football too.
He did some football, and of course national baseball stuff too. But That niche of being a team's broadcaster, bringing the game into people's house with your words on the radio, unprecedented. Just the best ever.
Well, think about this. Think about this 7-year stretch. He did Dwight Clark's catch in 1981 against the Cowboys.
Yeah.
1986, he does the Bill Buckner game. Right. And then 1988, the Kirk Gibson home run. How's that for a...
He's rolling.
That ain't bad. That's not a... But yeah, you're right. He goes all the way back to the Brooklyn Dodgers. He's the last link to the Brooklyn Dodgers,
And media guys on the train with the players and all that stuff. Yeah, that's right. And, man, what a career. Just such a perfect fit of a person to a job, the best of all time, you know? And again, by being so good at this really narrow thing, he was able to make it bigger than it was.
Yeah. I was thinking about this too, about how Scully, born in Brooklyn, ends up in LA. Russell, born in Monroe, Louisiana, grew up in Oakland, California, ends up in Boston. So these are guys that have kind of spanned the entire lower 48.
That's pro sports. That's what can happen. Yeah.
So I was reading a couple things. Bill Plaschke, the great LA Times columnist, he wrote about Scully. He called him our soundtrack, our song. And he went so far as to say, not only the greatest Dodger broadcaster, but the greatest LA Dodger period, which I thought was maybe... a little bit of a stretch.
Sandy Koufax.
I know. But then Mark Wicker, late of the Philadelphia Daily News, I've missed him forever. He has a Substack now, and he had a wonderful piece about Vin Scully where he described him as a tour guide, which I thought was a pretty nice, understated way to say it, as Wicker is not wont to do.
Right, that's good. I really like that.
So.
Yeah, that's great. I really like that.
So it was an excellent piece, as Wicker is very consistent that way and always has been. So.
And he kept doing it until what? When did he retire?
2016.
Yeah, okay.
67 years as a broadcaster. Ooh. That is a body of work there.
And was he, he would have been 86, 87 then?
When he quit? Yeah, because he was 94 at his death.
88 maybe.
Yeah, 88.
Yeah.
So, and really, I mean, you can see slippage with a lot of guys and you can sense it, but at least the times I heard him, just seemed like he was still as good as ever.
If he had been listening every night, you might have heard a little bit of it, but at the end, he was doing more of that storytelling kind of stuff, weaving it in. So you would get, I remember YouTube stuff of him going off on some tangent. So you actually got a little more of him late in the game. But, what a
body. Now, the other thing about him was, this is one thing that always drives me crazy about broadcasters, how they don't know when to shut up. And after Kirk Gibson's home run, he shut up.
Yeah, right.
And then, and then finally said, in a year so improbable, the impossible has happened, which I think is just such a wonderful way to describe it. And apparently, I've never heard this, but apparently he did Sandy Koufax's perfect game in 1965, and it was the same thing. He just shut up.
I think I read a transcript of that, actually, and it read like it was fun to read. Right. It read like a piece of great writing, you know?
Isn't that amazing?
The fans are carrying on, but they're umpiring with their hearts now. That pitch was outside, you know, that kind of stuff. And
so is he the last of a breed, or is John Miller the last of a breed? We no longer have the Harry Carries or the Mel Allens or anybody.
I don't know because that's still a thing. Uh-huh. Team baseball broadcasters, that's still a thing. I don't think we have anybody quite as good as Scully, but you know, it's funny because 100 years ago when I was doing the radio show, I had John Miller on.
Oh, he's so wonderful.
And he did an unbelievable Vin Scully imitation. I mean, he did imitations of all. He did Harry. He did all those guys. And he really nailed Scully. That makes me laugh to think about that.
He was at our banquet one time. And, of course, he told the Yolo Tango story about the original Mets with Elio Chacon and Richie Ashburn. Which was just, you knew it was coming and it was still wonderfully delivered.
You know, do you remember, you may not remember this, but remember the night we were just talking about with Andy Linker where we were all at the clubhouse waiting for Bonds?
Right.
Well, Miller was sitting right in the middle of that room playing cards and stuff like that.
I don't remember that.
He was right there, like, he was this far away from me, you know.
Wonderful broadcaster, really. It really has a great ear and a great sense of the game and a great sense of humor.
No question. Yeah, so I think that's still out there. Okay. I really like the Phillies' current radio.
Fransky is tremendous.
I think he's very good. Yeah. There's a tendency to say, well, there's never going to be another Vin Scully. Well, yeah, there's never going to be another Tiger Woods. I mean, you know.
Yeah, nobody's going to do it for 67 years.
You know? Well, that's a beefy number.
That is a 67 big years. Yeah. I mean, it's just, you can't even wrap your mind around somebody doing that job for 67 years.
I know. And that's part of what you mean when you say, God, what a great fit he was. He probably loved it for 67. I mean, he could have retired when he was our age, you know. Right. He did it for 20 years after that.
I think he was doing it for so long. I think he's been in the Hall of Fame for like 40 years or something ridiculous.
He's a veteran Hall of Fame.
But anyway, RIP to Vin Scully and Bill Russell. Absolutely. For sure. Two giants of their respective professions and really irreplaceable figures in a lot of respects. And
I can't think of anybody. I don't ever remember hearing criticism of Vin Scully.
No. Apparently he was as good as it gets. Well, that was what Bill Plaschke said in his story. Every time Vin Scully called him back, he always said, "Bill, this is Vin Scully," as if he had introduced himself. You know, it's like you kind of know the voice right away. Apparently there was some humility there too, I guess my point. So.
Right.
Anyway, we had some other business we wanted to talk about. The Phillies and the Orioles have both been busy this week before the trade deadline. And I thought the Phillies did a really impressive job. I mean, I'm going to go through the names of the guys they brought in. They addressed their rotation, their defense, their bullpen, and their infield. That's a pretty good week there.
Yeah, they got better defensively for sure. Mm-hmm. Well, maybe not for sure, but I think they got better defensively. Now, the center fielder they got,
Brandon Marsh,
he was a highly rated prospect. He was kind of sharing duty with Mike Trout. He definitely is a plus center fielder. He hasn't hit much.
Right.
And the shortstop they got has not hit at all.
Edmundo Sosa.
Yeah, he has not hit at all. But they got rid of Gregorius today.
Yeah, and they got rid of Odubel Herrera, which was a long time coming.
Yes, yeah. And so obviously these guys are going to get a chance to play. I mean, there's no doubt about that. And they addressed they got a little better in the bullpen, and I think they got a little better in the rotation.
Yeah, they brought back David Robertson, who they had signed, and then he didn't pitch for him because he was hurt, and now he's back from the Cubs. And he has had a very nice career. He had a good run with the Yankees.
And as they say, he's still throwing well now with a good fastball, good breaking ball. I mean, they say, you know, the scout consensus on him is he's fine. He's back from his injuries. And, you know, so, I think they did a nice job subtly. Yeah. You know, it's not Juan Soto. It's not even close to that. But the Phillies, Philly, I think they needed to address defense. They really were have been a bad defensive team for for a couple of years now.
Right.
And they're thinking they're going to get Harper back, and they're still in it. They're still right in the in this stupid playoff format. I think they did pretty good.
I think you can't do much better than that. And Noah, as we sit here on a Thursday, Noah Syndergaard, the guy they got from the Angels, will be pitching tonight. And here's what's interesting to me, kind of a sidelight. Do you remember a few years back that the Mets had this rotation of the future? And now the Phillies have half of it. They have Syndergaard and Zach Wheeler. And the only person from that rotation still with the Mets is Jacob DeGrom, and he's obviously had his physical issues. And the other one who we thought was maybe as good as any of them, Matt Harvey, he's... I don't think he's even in baseball
he's
anymore.
He's out of the picture. Well, I really like Wheeler. I like watching his pitch. I think his stuff is excellent. And Syndergaard does not throw as hard as he did at one time.
He's a big guy, but he's not throwing.
But they're saying that he's made some adjustments. He's going about a little bit differently. He's breaking stuff that's pretty effective. And, I mean, he's not going to be the number one guy. I mean, Wheeler's really the number one guy. But he'll help.
He'll be a good number three.
Yeah.
I mean, if they get into a playoff series, you know, they can line up Wheeler, Syndergaard, and Nola. That ain't bad.
That's why. And a lot of guys that can hit it over the fence, especially if Harper comes all the way back.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think they have a formula for being good in a short series if they get there.
Yeah.
I mean,
they haven't been in the playoffs in 11 years, so it's probably time to get back.
It's probably time to get back, especially now when you, 12 teams get in or whatever.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, and on the flip side, the Orioles dumped Trey Mancini and their closer, Jorge Lopez. Now, Mancini was in the last year of a contract. He was a long-tenured Oriole and a very successful Oriole. Yet, the Orioles are 3 games over .500 as we sit here for the first time since April of 2021. I mean, granted, they're probably not going to get in, but they, you know, they can hang around.
Yeah, I think this is probably evidence that they're thinking long term,
and they're
not selling out big to make it this year. That's how it feels to me.
I count 6 pitchers that they acquired in those deals, so it's like you kind of hope that percentage wise that some of them pan out, right?
Yeah,
that's just how it works.
Yeah, yeah, that's how it has to be. It's pitching is such a wild card. But Mancini in particular has been there a while, right?
Yeah, and he's been a pretty good player.
He's a pretty good player, but, you know, a first baseman who can hit a little, there's a lot of those guys around.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that you need to invest too hugely in a closer when you're probably not ready to win big yet. I mean, this feels to me like a long-term play.
They do seem like they're playing the long. I mean, and as you mentioned, I forget if it was last week or the week before, their farm system is ranked number one.
Yeah.
So they obviously have some guys who are waiting in the wings that they feel like will make them successful in the long term.
And again, they're in that same division with the Yankees and the Red Sox and the Blue Jays and Tampa.
Sure.
It's a long hill to climb.
But I mean, I do find it is kind of exciting. We've talked about this 100 times. It is kind of exciting that there's at least some rumblings.
And again, you know, when we had, this is an interesting thing. When we had, I'm drawing a blank on his name. The guy from Donegal that's the third base
Mike Sarbaugh.
Yeah, Mike Sarbaugh. When we had him on and I asked him about, do you think teams are going to be constructed a little bit differently now with the expanded? I think he misunderstood the question. I probably didn't ask it very well. But I think maybe the Orioles can be a little more optimistic now because they're not necessarily buried in the game because of the multiple wild cards.
Yeah,
they're not necessarily buried. And I think over time this might change the way rosters are constructed a little bit. I wasn't saying, well, we don't care about winning the division because we got the wild card, which I think is how Mike took it. We'll see. But maybe this is a little bit of a reason that format maybe really maybe some reason for optimism is what I'm trying to say for the Orioles.
I think that's fair. I mean, if the Phillies didn't win the trade deadline, then perhaps San Diego did because they got Juan Soto, Josh Bell, and Josh Hader. Two of those three are huge names, and Josh Bell is a very serviceable player. Also, they got Manheim Township's Ken Gallagher. So let's make sure we mention the local angle. But that lines up as a hell of a team because, you know, Fernando Tatis, Manny Machado and Juan Soto in the middle of your lineup is a pretty good engine room for any.
And it's an interesting that deal is really interesting because they controlled him for another 2.5.
Yeah.
The Nationals controlled Soto for another 2.5 seasons. On the other hand, they supposedly got like I think 3 very highly regarded prospects.
You would hope.
Yeah, right. Of course, you would hope. You know, he said he wasn't. They made him an offer for a staggering amount of money, and he said he wasn't interested. Presumably, he would take less money to go elsewhere. I don't know if he did. Did he?
I don't know if they've even gotten to the contract part of this yet.
But you know, so it is weird. Well, okay, you turned down the deal, but we still control you for 2.5 more years. That was a tough call. It's like so many baseball deals. Well, if the prospect's paying out, it'll look good, you know.
It'd be interesting to go back and look at a lot of these big deals and see what the percentage is on prospects. Yeah. Because it seems like it doesn't work out more often than not. And that's just, I say that basing it on nothing other than my singular impression of how these deals go.
You know what else, though? I'm not sure how you build a baseball team, a Major League Baseball team. I mean, we know that having great players in the NBA translates very directly to having a good team. Well, it doesn't in baseball. Clearly it doesn't.
Why is that? Because pitching is such a big part of it?
Well, no, I don't think that's it. The Angels might have the best player and best pitcher probably not, but close to it.
Yeah.
I'm kind of baffled by Major League Baseball, especially now. You know, this the farm system, obviously that's important, but is that critical? I don't know.
I think it is such a crapshoot because there are more players involved. You know, the NBA, you're only playing 5 at a time. In baseball, you might be playing all of your players on any given night.
Yeah, but there's more players, obviously, in football. Right. But it's pretty clear that the draft is the way you generally build your roster in the NFL. It's less clear. It's less clear what works to me, at least to me. Mm. Maybe I'm just being. I don't know how you build a baseball team.
That's an interesting thought. We'll have to get another baseball person on.
Yeah, that's right. That's a good idea, actually.
Anyway, well, let's move on. This is Penn State began preseason practice on Monday, and tomorrow is high school media day at LNP.
LNP's new headquarters, 101 North Queen Street.
How do we feel? I guess my first question is, how do we feel about a 37-team colossus of a league? That seems really unwieldy to me.
Yeah. Well, what's happened is the Berks County League there were 13 schools in that league. So it was 2 divisions, 1 with 7, 1 with 6, which was that's weird. If you have 6, you only have 5 league opponents. You got to come up with 5 non-league games. Plus, some of the small schools in Berks County are really powerhouses. Why I'm missing is a state power example. So their league was unworkable, and our league was kind of stupidly structured the last couple of years, I thought. So this is better than either of the situations that all these schools are leaving in order to form this merger. 37 teams, 5 sections, and tomorrow's going to be interesting. It's having all those kids running around that building, and we'll see how it goes. And covering it is going to be a challenge.
It's got to be. It's got to be because, on any given night, you're going to have how many games? 18 games any given Friday night?
Yeah, and early in the year when they were playing non-league games, it'll be more than that.
Oof.
We're not going to be able to get to all of them. I should point out, though, that here's something interesting that's happened that's kind of different from a media standpoint. Our pal Mike Drago, who runs his own website in covering Berks County sports, has partnered with our company. I think 5 guys that are more or less stringers that are going to cover games, and their stories are going to run in both.
Oh, outlets. That's good. That's yeah, really good.
And it's a partnership. It's business. There's some.
That's smart.
Sharing of the cost in that's going to be involved. And
that's really smart.
There are some details to figure out about that. I'm not sure what happens if Wilson's playing Manheim Township in a huge game in Week 9, like, who covers that game? I mean, Drago's going to want to, and Reinhardt's going to want to. I mean, that kind of stuff needs to be worked out, I think.
That's interesting. I mean, that's a great idea, yeah. First of all. But yeah. Just because it is such an unwieldy thing to have to cover.
Yeah. So I
suspect the way it should happen is if it's at Wilson, he should do it. And if it's down here, we should do it.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah. I don't even know if that's been talked about. Maybe that's been worked out, but I'll probably find out tomorrow.
But that's interesting to me. So how long is this thing if there are 37 teams?
Well, it's 5 sections, and it's an hour and a half for each section. So I'm going to be there all day. I'm going to get there.
That is a long day.
It starts at 10 o'clock. I'm probably going to get there at 9 o'clock. I probably won't be home until 7 or something like that, but you know, whatever.
It'd be sticking ditches. will Mike Clare be there to provide hot dogs?
That's Mike Clare will not be there, but there will be food and there will be swag.
Swag.
We're providing swag.
Well, I think I'll just show up for the swag.
Yeah, show up for the swag.
Is there anything that's emerged in these first few days of Penn State preseason practice of note?
Not really. I mean, I've seen the normal little. They let the media, I didn't go up, of course, for this, but they let the media watch like 20 minutes on Monday.
Something.
it's something. And some of the guys are, like, for example, P.J. Mustafer, who I think is a defensive tackle, I think is a really key figure, is now fully participating. He was not fully participating in spring. He wanted to. Tore up his knee in the Iowa game last year, and really it was a very serious knee injury. I think it might have been multiple tears. So he apparently is all the way back. Other than that,
Well, that's a very important development because he's going to be a very important guy for their team. A really good player. Probably an NFL-level player if he's right.
Yeah, if he's right. And a really nice guy, too. A smart guy, an articulate guy.
We like those.
Yeah, he's one of my favorites in recent years. Saturday is Penn State's media day, so our boy Dave and I will be making the trek.
Well, you got to practice that stuff too.
That's right. A lot of material to work on, a lot of things to think about. I don't know that we'll get a sense on Saturday of much of anything, but we'll talk to some people and see what happens.
Yeah, talk to some people.
Yeah,
try to tell some people. Just the thought of preseason practice made me think of this, just how NFL training camps are covered now and nowadays. Andrew Callahan, our friend and former guest on our podcast, covers the Patriots for the Boston Herald. And his breakdown of each drill, like who was the intended target, what Mac Jones's completion percentage was like in any period. It's really, I guess it speaks to the fact that there is an insatiable appetite for NFL content.
Yep.
So if you're going to talk about, Mac Jones being 7 for 10 in a, in a 7-on-7, people will eat that up. I mean, here I'm completely guilty myself because the Packers have a rookie receiver named Romeo Doubs, and apparently he's playing great. So I have him going to the Hall of Fame already before he's ever played a snap.
There you go.
So I'm as guilty as anyone.
It is. Sometimes we forget we're so immersed in other sports and other I'm obviously more immersed in college football. You sometimes forget a little bit how big a deal the NFL is.
It's a 12-month-a-year thing.
And we should point out two repeat guests on this show, Andrew and Jordan Rodriguez, are just doing an unbelievable job. If you follow them on Twitter.
Oh, my gosh.
I'm following them both. I'm thinking, if I'm a fan of either of these teams, this is awesome. I mean, the detail that they're giving you, just on Twitter, because
both of them know the game so well.
Yeah,
and here's what I think of when I see Andrew's breakdowns. I think, this guy must, you know, be exhausted at the end of the day. Yeah. That's what I think about. Yeah. You know?
And she just, Jordan is just such a good observer.
Yeah.
Little things. And she'll just pick up her phone and take 15 seconds of video of something that's different and cool and weird. And Andrew just, Andrew could probably coach.
Yeah.
So they're very similar, but a little different. But anyway, the level of detail and coverage
it's
that you're
great.
Getting, if you're a fan of either of those teams, check them out.
Yeah. So Andrew, as I recall, went to the University of Connecticut, and the way he got on this track was he wanted to know about the game, and he actually sat down with some people on the football staff, and they explained.
I think it was that Paul Pasqualoni's staff.
I think you're right.
Who coached Perry Patterson.
I did not know
That's what he was
thinking. How about that?
At Syracuse, anyway.
But, you know, it just speaks to Andrew's commitment to this, that he wanted to be immersed even when he was an undergrad in college, and it has carried him to, I think, the logical conclusion. He's covering an NFL team for a major media outlet.
The New England Patriots for the Boston Herald.
Which, you know, I think it's very much deserved, and I'm happy for him. I'm happy for Jordan. I'm glad they're doing what they're doing because they do a great job day in and day out. So,
if you're a fan, whatever NFL team you are a fan of, I hope you, if you're a fanatic, I hope you have somebody like those two.
Yeah.
That's just, I mean, the detail.
It's so great. It really is.
It's impressive. Yeah.
So we're going to take a jump from football over to the NBA. There's a couple Sixers things we wanted to discuss. A, they're going to build a new arena downtown. They're going to break ground in 2026, and they want to be done in time for the 2031 season.
Yeah, it's a long way off, but it's still interesting that they're going downtown.
Mm-hmm.
There's so many things about that are almost politically interesting, and in terms of
infrastructure.
Yes, that's exactly right. Infrastructure and are they relying on America turning to mass transit a little more than it already has? Which I hope happens. I hope they're right if that's what they're banking on.
It is interesting because a lot of people have said, well, really, is SEPTA going to be able to, you know, meet this challenge? You know, because it's like, I mean, I'll tell you what, a couple years ago when I was doing some Sixers for Forbes, after work, I would take the train in, then take an Uber down to South Philly. The funniest story of that is a little sidelight. One time I was on the train. We hit a deer. The Amtrak train hit a deer. So I don't know where we were, if we were in an Ambler or wherever.
I'm sorry to animal lovers. For
yes, exactly. So we were delayed. So wouldn't that be the night that Ben Simmons makes his first career three-pointer? I missed the first quarter. But my point being is, If you're going from Lancaster to there, it's a lot easier to get to an arena in Center City than it is to South Philly.
Yeah.
It really is.
Yeah. Yeah. Even the couple of times I remember, like when we went, like when Penn State was playing Temple down there, it would have been easier to go somewhere downtown. Now, obviously the football's a different animal, but I tend to kind of like this idea.
Right.
Here's another thing I hadn't thought of. And I read some stuff about this today that I think this is a little bit of a reach, but it's still interesting that they'll be able to provide kind of creature comforts for the players that they're not able to provide now, and maybe that'll make the Sixers more attractive. That seems like a reach.
I think that stuff is always overrated.
Yeah,
I really do.
Yeah, that seems like a reach to me. But stuff that I never thought of, like they'll have a place where guys can do individual workouts. There are a place where guys can go after the game. They'll have a place where a skills coach or one of the staff can work one-on-one or with one with two players. And the current arena is lacking in that way. I never even thought about that.
No, nor I. And
I don't think it's that big a deal, but it was just interesting to me to read that.
Because I know the Wizards arena, they actually have their practice court in their arena. They have a downtown arena. But the Sixers just built this huge practice facility across the river in Camden, which is a really, really nice place and a huge improvement over when they trained at PCOM. So I don't know why they need a practice thing there necessarily.
Yeah,
it seems a little strange to me.
Yeah.
Why would you need that when you... It seems redundant.
Throwing a lot
of money. But yes, back to your point. I mean, it just seems like... I don't think any free agent is saying, oh, yeah, I'm coming here because they have this arena here.
That's what I thought, too, when I was reading this piece. I thought, but I hadn't even thought of that element of it at all. But the other thing is, they supposedly they are partnered with some like real estate tycoon that has a lot of apartments in the city.
Oh, is that right? I know that.
He's immersed in it. I mean, if you think about the fact that this is 9 years away and the political bullshit that's going to go on behind the scenes to make this happen, it's kind of mind-blowing.
Yeah. It's got to be. Just for bookkeeping purposes, it's supposed to cost $1.3 billion and it's supposed to be privately funded.
That's what they're saying. In fact, what I've been reading is that it essentially has been privately funded.
Okay.
The money is there.
So I'm really interested to see how this all pans out from all those perspectives that you mentioned.
Yeah, because it's, God knows what we're going to be doing in 2031.
Well, it's Mike Sielski, who another former guest of our pod, he wrote a column where he said, what are the Sixers even going to look like by then? Because Embiid's going to be gone. Oh, yeah. Everybody on the current roster will no longer be playing.
It's enormously speculative. I think they have a feeling that they're going to be one of the sort of marquee franchises in the league. And I don't know. Maybe they will.
But again, that gets back to variables. I mean, who knows? Who knows who's, you know, is Josh Harris even going to still be owning the team?
Yeah.
I mean, it's like there's 100 things that could really make this blow up.
but the just thinking about it broadly, I like the idea of a downtown.
I do. I mean, it's selfishly, I do, because I just think it'd be easier to get to.
Yeah. And it's just sort of cool that Philly, a little bit. Philadelphia, I like Philadelphia. I do. I always like Philadelphia. Very rough around the edges, needless to say. But there's always been a little bit of a sense of Philadelphia to me that there's no there in the downtown. A little bit. There is stuff down there, of course. But this sports complex, it's sort of on the edge. And I understood that, and that was workable. But downtown is pretty... That's pretty cool. I'm generally in favor of that, in theory.
Yeah, it's interesting you say that because I remember when they built Citizens Bank Park. I think it was Phil Sheridan who was then an Inquirer columnist. He wrote a column where he said he kind of wished the stadium was a little closer to town, so you actually had the skyline closer to the outfield. I mean, it's nice.
Think of Pittsburgh.
Yeah. Really, oh my God, that's like immersed in the downtown.
Yeah, that is such a. Yeah. That's almost weird how that's in your.
Yeah. Baltimore to some extent.
Yeah.
Too.
Sure. Yeah. That's. Yeah.
So I kind of get the point. I mean, I like the ballpark. I think it's a nice place to go.
It's a nice ballpark.
But I see his point. It's like it would be nice if it's like, you know, just part of the cityscape. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So
I'm kind of in a broad way in favor of it.
Yeah. The other thing is the Sixers are going to be, this was announced by the NBA on July 29th, they're being investigated for tampering related to the James Harden, PJ Tucker, Daniel House signings that the NBA ain't quite buying the fact that Harden was willing to give up $15 million to play next year just so that they could sign PJ Tucker to 3 years and $30 million and Daniel House to 2 years and $8.4 million. I think this is a nothing burger because the Bulls, Heat, and Bucks have all been investigated in recent years, and they had to give up a second-round pick. Big deal.
I don't think the fact that Harden was giving up the money, I don't think that by itself is evidence. No. I mean, I understand what they're saying. I don't know enough about this, honestly.
I don't know. I'm not sure I buy that anybody's willing to give up $15 million, least of all an NBA player.
But what alternative explanation is there?
I don't know.
There's
a little, you know, under the table thing going to Harden. You know, that Daryl Morey, for whom he worked when he was in Houston, and he's just saying, "Hey, you do us a solid now, we'll do you a solid later."
But is that illegal?
I don't know. I mean, I think it does.
I think that has happened in the
past. That is a great point. I mean, I think the NBA is notorious for tampering, but I think it's really difficult to police. You know, you have all these guys that, you know, they sign deals like 1 minute after the signing period begins. So you're saying that they negotiated this deal in a minute? It's just silly.
Yeah.
I mean, but I guess they're trying to... I mean, somebody suggested that the fact that they and the Knicks also for the Jalen Brunson signing are being investigated indicates that some other team complained about either or both of them.
Right.
So somebody cried foul.
Yeah.
So that could be. But again, I think the penalty will be minimal.
It's interesting because here's an interesting thing about this. To what extent do the Players Association and the owners almost partner up on these kind of things?
That's an interesting point.
I really don't know the answer to that, and I don't know where.
I mean, it seems like in that sport, more than any other, there is a partnership, although I question how much there is now, because of the player empowerment in this era, and just because the players have been flexing a lot more and saying, hey, I want to play with that guy and that guy and that guy. Yeah. And I don't think it's as it once was, where it seemed when the league was on shakier financial footing, that there was more of a partnership. I think it's more, maybe adversarial is the wrong word, but not as close as it once was.
So, but I mean, you could argue that the Players Association would want this Harden thing investigated. We don't want to see our people taking less money than they could get. We don't want to see the open market limited in any way.
Fair.
Here's another, relatedly, we're going on another topic here, but the Deshaun Watson thing. Oof. What was the, as nightmarish as that is, what do you think is the owner Players Association relationship there? Do the Players Association want to see, are they kind of okay with outside arbitrators making this 6 games so they don't have to try to defend him?
I don't know. Well, it was that not collectively bargained ahead of time that there was going to be a third party for
decision? Yeah, it was collectively bargained. So, but I mean, like, I wonder if the Players Association is thinking, man, I'm glad we don't have to defend this guy. I'm glad we don't. You know what I'm saying?
I'm sure in this case in particular, I'm sure that's the case. I mean, the fact that he got 6 games and now the NFL is appealing the severity of the penalty. And it's to the point where this whole process could play out in slow time, where he could actually play the season opener.
Yeah.
Because, you know, there won't be any penalty in place. That could theoretically happen.
Yeah.
So, I think is shameful. I mean, there's a lot of things we could talk about with that.
It does seem like a pretty small penalty.
I think.
To me. Yeah. It does seem, I never know, like, what the, even when I was a parent, I didn't know, like, what's the right punishment here? Sure. I don't know, but it's hard to know. But this seems.
Yeah.
This seemed a little late to me.
Because what did Calvin Ridley, for betting on a game, he got a season. Josh Gordon, who's a repeat offender for weed, he got 25-plus games. And this guy gets 6 games?
I know. There's so many things like that are just not...
Does not add up at all.
Oh, that's another podcast. I'm starting to...
Yeah.
My mind's starting to...
Yeah, I agree.
...go on another road. But yeah, that's... anyway, that's... it's one of those things where you wish you knew what was really going on behind the scenes. Yeah.
So the last thing I wanted to close out with, Bob Swavely, who is a former assistant basketball coach at Conestoga Valley. He died yesterday of pancreatic cancer, and he was a longtime coach. He also played at CV. Doug Kraft informed me on Twitter that Bob had a memorable end game against Chambersburg in the state playoffs in 1966, his senior year at CV, and where he scored 4 points in 5 seconds in the second overtime, which was something only Doug Kraft could know.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
So I wanted to wish melancholy happy trails, to borrow a phrase from Tony Kornheiser and Mike Wilbon, to Bob, because over the years I had a lot of interactions. He was a longtime assistant to Bob Borden at CV, and they usually had competitive teams. They were always well-organized, seemed always well-coached. And Bob was he's a very feisty guy. He was one of those guys that the referees knew they were going to have some conversation. Bob was that kind of a guy. And, you know, in more recent years, he was a Carolina guy. I'm a Duke guy. So we had interesting discussions on Facebook about that. But I really liked Bob, and he did me a lot of kindnesses over the years that I always appreciated. So I wanted to say RIP to him and best to his family and go from there.
RIP. There are too much RIPs in this show, but otherwise, I thought it was pretty good. So, all right. So, we're out, I guess, huh?
I think that's it until next time. And next week, we hope to have Paul Domowicz, late of the Philadelphia Daily News, and he is out at the Pro Football Hall of Fame ceremonies. And you might want to check out his long feature story that is on the 33rdteam.com about Dick Vermeil, who is going to be inducted this weekend. Paul has been on our show before. He's a great guest and, you know, knows football inside
really
and
out. Really knows the NFL. And so that'll be fun.
So we look forward to having him with us next week. And
that's it, gang.
Until then.
I'm Mike. He's Gordy. See ya.
See you later.